It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. While physical schools have been closed this spring, school has been in session on Talk of Iowa. Today is our final class of the 2019-2020 school year, but Talk of Iowa summer camp starts next week. You can join us every Tuesday throughout the summer for fun and educational ideas, projects, and experiences. We're going to start with astronomy camp next week. Today, we focus once again on Iowa history, and we're going back to the beginning. For thousands of years before European settlers came to Iowa and turned it into the state that we're all familiar with, indigenous people lived on, hunted on, and traveled through this land between two rivers. The Meskwaki Nation is an important part of Iowa history and Iowa present. And later this hour, we'll listen back to my conversation with Jonathan Buffalo, Historic Preservation Director for the Meskwaki Nation. But first, two men who have dedicated much of their lives to learning about the indigenous people of Iowa. Lance Foster is on the line. He is a historian and archaeologist, vice chairman of the Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska, and tribal historic preservation officer. He's also the author of The Indians of Iowa. Hello, Lance.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm glad to do so.
Bill Whitaker is also here with us. He is research director with the Office of the State Archaeologist at the University of Iowa. He's co-author of The Archaeological Guide to Iowa. Hello, Bill.
Hello. Thank you for having us again.
Well, it's wonderful to have both of you on the show. And Lance, I want to start with a little bit of your own personal history, because in The Indians of Iowa, you write about what it was like when you went to school at Iowa State University back in the early 90s and started looking for information about the indigenous people who lived in this state. You didn't find much. Tell me about that.
No, I mean, those were the days when people started using the internet, the ordinary people, and those first browsers started coming out, like in, I think it was Mosaic was one. And I started looking to see what was out there, and the only thing I could find was something about these Iowa Indians, and it was the Fluxus Indian Museum. And I started reading, and I said, that's not the Iowa tribe I know about that I'm part of. So I contacted them and asked them, and they said it was an art project. And they didn't know that there was a tribe called the Iowa Indians. So I started doing kind of an internet page called Native Nations of Iowa. And that kind of started my journey with communicating with people about our history.
And of course, you found a rich history, not just of the Iowa people, but of many indigenous nations that made their homes in Iowa, right?
Yes, many. Of course, before, I mean, you go further back you go, it gets a little cloudy on, well, tribes rejoined and separated and stuff. So a lot of the tribal names that we know, some go back way back into prehistory, but other tribes really achieved their current identity probably in the 1500s, 1400s, partly as a result of all the domino effect that was going across the United States with the arrival of the colonists.
Bill, tell me a little bit about your history, because you have dedicated a great deal of your career as an archaeologist to putting the pieces of this puzzle together and making it possible for people to learn about the indigenous people that lived in Iowa. When you first started looking, what did you find?
Well, yeah, first I want to start off by saying that, you know, Lance and Jonathan are, you know, have been studying the history of Native Americans far longer than I have, and they have a much better grasp of it. So if I say anything that contradicts them, they're probably right. But yeah, I started off as an archaeologist in Iowa. My interest in Native Americans had always been there, but it was really grew because we did a lot of excavations just by chance on several historic forts from the time period when Europeans were first took over Iowa. You know, we excavated at Fort Atkinson, at Fort Des Moines, number 2 in downtown Des Moines. We excavated at Fort Madison in Lee County. And from that grew a book on the frontier forts of Iowa, and then that grew into a greater interest in trying to document the location of these things. And this eventually led me to look more skeptically at some of the early maps of Iowa, which just kind of show a blank slate with a few European settlements and forts stuck in there. Well, where are all the Indians? So sort of this real long-term side project called the Historic Indian Location Database, where we went through thousands and thousands and thousands of newspaper accounts and county histories and firsthand accounts, and trying to pin down every location we could find where Native Americans were. And currently we have about 1,200 locations in Iowa where we can pin down where Native Americans resided or were seen in the historic period of Iowa. And that's really changed, you know, my view of Iowa. And I think helping to flesh out where tribes existed and how their ranges change and where they're seen, and when you find an archaeology site, who it might be associated with.
Well, and we have
it's really grown.
Yeah, we have put a link to the Iowa Historic Indian Location Database on our website, iowapublicradio.org. If you look for the web post about this programming and you scroll down to the bottom, we have a group of discussion questions or activity ideas that you can pursue. And if you're near a computer right now, I recommend clicking on that link right now as we have this conversation. It's great to look at a map of Iowa and really start to understand where the different groups that we talk about during the hour lived historically. And as you said, Lance, things are a little foggy in this prehistoric period because, of course, the history wasn't written down. But also, I think it's really important to note right now that one of the reasons that even 30 years ago, when you went looking for information on Indians of Iowa, there wasn't a lot, because this history was erased by settlement. And that was a purposeful thing. Lance?
Well, I think it's a complex thing. And, you know, you have different ways of knowledge. There's archaeological knowledge. There's historical knowledge. There's overlaps there. But then indigenous people have our own oral histories about these things. And in our oral histories, we generally have traditional myths and stories about our being created here. Just like biblical stories about Adam and Eve being created in a place and then kind of dispersing from that place, we all have our own individual stories about how we were created in different places here. My own tribe, the Iowas, we have stories from our clans, and the clans came from the land and from the air and from the waters, and came together and formed tribes. And those are our stories that we rely on, and that's our basis for who we are. It's been interesting trying to kind of match that up with some of the things that archaeology shares with us. And sometimes you have to make a choice about which one you want to kind of go with. And it depends on how you want to see yourself and who you are in the world, you know?
Well, and I think, you know, the way this history has been taught is changing over time. Of course, I went to school in the 80s and early 90s, and there wasn't a lot of nuance to what we were taught. But it's exciting that there is so much more available today for people who choose to seek out this history. And I do want to spend a little time before we talk more about the Iowa people and some of the other tribes that we may be more familiar with today. Bill, can you take us back further? Because across the state of Iowa, there are mounds. And this is something that I think a lot of Iowans think about when they think about the Native people who lived here before settlement, because the mounds are such a unique and special part of the environment in Iowa. And of course, the Effigy Mounds National Monument is a beautiful place with incredible history and a wonderful place to visit. But help me understand what we know about the people who would have left these mounds behind.
Oh, sure. The mounds were built by Native Americans. Native Americans have been in Iowa for 13,000 years, and over that time, they gradually changed and changed their life ways and their lifestyles. And by a time period, which we call the woodland, roughly beginning about 100 BC, they started constructing these mounds, these piles of earth and soil, usually over human burials, And these were very protected sacred ceremonial locations. And we have a fair number of them left still in Iowa, and you can visit a lot of them. And those mounds were constructed right up into the historic period. One of the things that's come out of the Hild database is that there are a fair number of accounts of historic Native Americans constructing mounds in the mid-1800s in Iowa, which is something that was, you know, kind of a surprise to a lot of people. So there is a long tradition of mound building. It's deeply associated with Native Americans, and it was certainly one of the most earliest things that early European settlers noted about the landscape. There was a time period in the late 19th century when Europeans were actually trying to deny that Native Americans were building mounds, but the archaeological and historic evidence is just overwhelming that it is completely done by Native Americans for Native American purposes.
And of course, there have been mounds that have been demolished or deconstructed, but we look at effigy mounds, for example, and many of those mounds are still intact. How do we know what is beneath the ground?
Up until the early 1970s, archaeologists would dig into mounds, and also amateur archaeologists would often dig into mounds, and we could look at the reports of what they found from those to determine if they were burial locations and the types of burials that were in them. In Iowa, beginning in the 1970s, there was a series of controversies about the treatment of Native Americans and the treatment of mounds. And that led to some of the earliest protections for Native American burial sites in the nation occurred in Iowa. And it's, you know, it's been a long, long time since professional archaeologists have intentionally dug into a mound for research. You know, so but there is a lot of data from previous work done out there. Right now, a lot of the work that has been done over the past couple decades is actually repatriating a lot of the remains from mounds that have been dug up and returning them to Native American groups so that they can reinter them by their own customs.
We're going to have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, archaeologist Bill Whitaker and Lance Foster, author of The Indians of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. School is in session today, although it's the last day of school for Iowa Public Radio School. We are digging into Iowa history once again. And if you've enjoyed these programs over the past few weeks about biology and Iowa history, please tune in for Talk of Iowa Summer Camp. We start next Tuesday with Astronomy Camp here on Talk of Iowa. This hour, we're learning about the first people who lived on the land that would become Iowa. The history is far deeper than that of our state as we know it. For thousands of years before European settlers came to Iowa, indigenous people lived on this land. And with me this hour, Lance Foster, historian and archaeologist. He's also vice chairman of the Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska, tribal historic preservation officer of the tribe, and also author of The Indians of Iowa. Bill Whitaker is also here. He is research director with the Office of the State Archaeologist at the University of Iowa and co-author of The Archaeological Guide to Iowa. And we would love to hear from you if you have questions for Bill and Lance. Later in the hour, we're going to listen back to a conversation that I recorded in 2011 with Jonathan Buffalo, Historic Preservation Director for the Meskwaki Nation, which of course is a very important part of Iowa's history and Iowa's present. So we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the Meskwaki over the next 15 minutes, but Lance, can you help us understand a little bit about this land that came to be known as Iowa? Of course, we know that this land is fertile and it is a place that attracted farmers well before settlement as well. What do we need to know about this land and the role it would have played in the lives of the nations that lived here?
Well, a few things that might be good to remember. We don't really have mountains and things like that in Iowa. What we have as the geographic focus are rivers. And the rivers, like you called it, the land between two rivers, the Missouri and the Mississippi, you have rivers flowing into both of those, and it ties down just south of the mouth of the Des Moines. And what's really interesting about that is one of our chiefs, Snowheart, who was a direct ancestor of mine and many others in the Iowa tribe, as part of the treaty negotiations, which ceded some of the land to in Iowa to the United States. There's a pretty famous map that he drew, in concert with others, but he presented the map, and he noted that from time immemorial, time out of mind, between the rivers, those rivers were named by the Iowas. It was noted as our land because of the burials there, that we knew all these places, and that not one other nation could come into that area without our agreement up until that time. Now, history also shows that there was conflict between, from the north, the Dakota coming towards the south, and the Sauk and Meskwaki, or Sac and Fox, coming from the east, and they kind of clashed in the middle of Iowa, which talks about the buffer zone and the shape of Iowa as we know it today. But the rivers were named by our people, our traditions say, and were translated in other languages. And the rivers were generally named after resources that were found there that were numerous. For example, in the southeast part of the state, southwest part of the state, the Sheraton, which goes into Missouri, comes from the word Sheraton. Shara was the yellow lotus, which we ate the roots from, and the Missouri people also ate, which were related. So the Iowa, the Oto, the Missouri, and the Ho-Chunk or Winnebago were all part of this nation that over time fragmented. By the time non-Indians came to the land, there were distinct identities between these people.
I think that's so important to note because, again, we're talking about thousands of years of history. And when we talk about Native American tribes, I think a lot of us have this idea that these nations are fixed in history. But I'm hearing you say that there it was fluid. Things changed over time.
Yes. For example, on our reservation here, we have a site called the Leary Site, which is a National Historic Landmark. And our people came here starting in the 1200s as part of a trading network that extended onto the plains with the Pawnee and other people to the east, to the west and south, the Plains Apache. And this this land here also had Hopewell Mounds up on top. So there are layers of history. It's like stratigraphy and archaeology. There are layers. A place that's good to live at any point because of the rivers and resources is a good place to live, and it will continue to be so. And that's why Des Moines is where it is, and most of our towns today are because that's where it was good, and that's where people had fertile soil. That's where there was good transportation. And, you know, if you look at the land, look, is it like a layer cake? And all these places on it kind of overlay each other.
Let's talk a little bit about the Iowa people, your people. Each one of the nations that was part of Iowa had a separate culture and a separate language. So we cannot lump all of these nations together, but introduce us just briefly, and we could spend, I know, hours talking about it, but briefly to the Iowa people, what do we know?
Well, there are two kind of language stocks, primary language stocks spoken in Iowa, the Algonquian ones with Meskwaki speak and the Siouan language, which the Iowa, Dakota, Winnebago were part of that language family, just like English is part of the Germanic language family. So our languages are very different. Our history goes back very far. Our way of life was kind of a combination of villages along the rivers, with a lot of gardening, a lot of farming, corn, beans, and squash, and then at least two trips per year to go hunt buffalo where the buffalo work. You actually could follow the Des Moines River, which we call the River of the Buffalo, all the way up into southwest Minnesota, which were the calving grounds of the buffalo. And there were reports even into the 1820s and 30s of some of the U.S. military that noted the buffalo up in that area. Of course, that was wiped out once the settlers came over and started converting to agriculture. But our people, one of the things probably we're best known for was trading before across the state. For example, when the French met us, they noted that our wealth was in Catlinite pipes, pipestones, the red pipestone, and buffalo hides, and that was part of that trade network. Our traditions are that we were the first, us and the Oto were the first ones to discover the pipestone in historic and just prehistoric times, started doing the trade in both raw stone and carved pipes and tablets with these carvings of buffalo and things on them. So we were probably the most numerous, and we started dying out once the United States started coming in with all the epidemics and stuff. We became fewer and fewer, and that's why people don't know us except for the state name. And the state name, it doesn't mean beautiful land. It doesn't mean the land between two rivers. When Lieutenant Pike came for the Americans in 1806 up along the Mississippi River, he noted the River of the Iowas, where they named rivers after the people who lived on them. And then he said, this is the Iowa country. And then when Iowa became a territory, it took its name from the Iowa country, which was named for the river, which was named for the people. So that's kind of where the name of Iowa came from.
And you just exploded a myth that we were all taught when we were children that Iowa meant beautiful land. But I think that's a better story, Lance. I want to ask you, Bill, quickly, in thinking about archaeological records of the indigenous people who lived in Iowa, of course, a lot of the things that indigenous people lived with would not have been left behind for an archaeological record. What kinds of things do you find that help us understand how people lived here?
Oh, sure. In archaeology, you know, the thing that probably comes to mind to most people would be, you know, arrowheads and spear points. And those are important, and they are helpful to sort of figuring out when a site was occupied and what it looked like. And they preserve very well because they're made of stone. But we can also have organic materials preserve if the conditions are right. For example, if an Oneota village, and the Oneota were sort of what we call the people who are now known as the Iowa and Oto and Missouri and Ho-Chunk, if they had a village and they had a storage pit, often because it's buried, the corn can be preserved within it, charred remains can be preserved. So we can get a sense of the types of food that are being eaten in the prehistoric period. We can get an idea of when different varieties of corn appeared at different sites. We can get an idea of the types of animals that they were hunting. You can get an idea of the different ways that they distributed their food. So if a preservation is good at a site, you can actually learn quite a great deal about human activity and how it changes over time, and how people change their economies to adjust to different climates and to adjust to the appearance of Europeans. So yeah, there's a lot out there.
We're talking about the indigenous people who lived in the land that would become Iowa before statehood. And of course, many indigenous people live here still. We're going to find out more about the Meskwaki Nation in just a few minutes. With me, Lance Foster, author of The Indians of Iowa, Bill Whitaker, co-author of The Archaeological Guide to Iowa. And now, I think students today are more savvy and more informed than students were when I was growing up. But Bill, let me ask you about the Wikiup, a building that many Native groups would have used to live in. When I was growing up, we only really learned about the teepee, which was part of the culture as well. But tell me about a wikiup.
Well, a wikiup is a variety of house that is what would have been common in Iowa at the time period when Europeans first arrived. They're very closely associated with the Meskwaki and the Sauk, who are Algonquian-speaking tribes who came in the 1700s. But structures like that are suspected prehistorically throughout Iowa and throughout the Oneota period. Teepees, as we know them, you know, probably did occur in Iowa, but they were not the dominant form of occupation. You know, it's more like that wikiups and longhouses, and in western Iowa, you had semi-subterranean houses called earth lodges were quite common, in which, you know, the Native Americans would dig into the ground. They would put a heavy timber frame over it, and then they would cover that frame with soil. So you'd be living in this well-insulated, well-protected house, you know, that which could last for decades. And that was, you know, common prehistorically along in western Iowa. So yeah, there's all kinds of different ways Native Americans built houses, depending upon the particular situation, depending on how long they're going to be at a particular camp or village, depending on how many people were there. So it was very, very fluid as to the types of structures that were built. Native Americans were very adept at adapting to their local conditions, yes.
We have a question from Gerald in Winterset, and I think it's probably a little harder to answer than Gerald might have anticipated. His question is, how many tribes were in Iowa? And Lance, counting up the number of tribes that you wrote about in your book, I count 13. Looking at your historic database, the Historic Indian Location Database, Bill, I count 7. Lance, do you want to try to answer that question and tell us why it's hard to answer?
Sure. For one thing, it's kind of hard to answer because what time period are we talking about? If we're talking about now, well, the Meskwaki are the only ones living there now, except for those who are urban people who might be Navajo. They might be people scattered all over the state today. Also, the Omaha and the Ho-Chunk, the Winnebago, they have land in Iowa as well. They have the Dakota people still are there, but it depends because some people, like, for example, back in the 1600s, there was a brief period when the Ottawa and some of the Huron visited Iowa for about 5 or 10 years when they got driven out of that further area east by the Iroquois, and they lived in Iowa for a little bit and decided it was too flat for them and not enough forest. So they moved out. So it's hard to say exact numbers because you're talking about, we're talking about the 1600s? Are we talking about the 1820? The Potawatomi, for example, lived there for just a decade or two, and then they had been moved out. So that's why it's hard to actually pick a particular number for tribes.
We are just scraping the surface of this subject this hour. And as I mentioned, we're going to dig deeper into Meskwaki history in just a moment. We've talked about a number of different resources. The Indians of Iowa, Lance, your book is a wonderful way to learn about the people who lived in Iowa. And Bill, you've also written about the Native groups in the Archaeological Guide to Iowa and other works as well. There are online places where you can learn more, including this Historic Indian Location Database and other resources. Lance, obviously this is something that people could spend a great deal of time learning about and digging into. There are so many resources out there. Why do you believe it's important for people to learn about this part of our history?
Well, I think no matter where you are or what your motivation is, I think you can only be enriched by learning about your local history. And that includes the Native people that were there that might still be there. And a lot of us, because of the collapse of our population at times, some of us are darker and some of us are lighter, sort of like ears of Indian corn. It's the same ear of corn, but some of the kernels are lighter and some are darker, but it's the same people. Because sometimes with population collapse, people intermarried. And sometimes they married the local white family, and so their kids might be a little lighter than the stereotypical idea of Indian people. So it's a huge variety of stories about your local landscape, about why did that river or creek get its name the way it is. Sometimes people even have spiritual experiences, and they feel things, they have dreams, they experience odd occurrences and things, and they're trying to connect to that history, that memory in the land. And so I think the variety of things, people can never really exhaust that. And I think it only really, like I said, will enrich your understanding of yourself and where you live.
Well, Lance Foster, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Charity.
Lance Foster, a historian and archaeologist. He is vice chairman of the Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska. He's also tribal historic preservation officer and the author of The Indians of Iowa. Bill Whitaker, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
Bill Whitaker, Research Director with the Office of the State Archaeologist at the University of Iowa. He's also co-author of The Archaeological Guide to Iowa. And again, I mentioned it before, but the Historic Indian Location Database Bill has put together, and it gives you a visual image of where Native people lived historically in the state of Iowa. And of course, in just a moment, we will learn more about the Meskwaki people. The Meskwaki people are an important part of our history, but also an important part of our present here in Iowa. School is in session on Talk of Iowa. We continue in a moment. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, school is in session, and we're learning about the indigenous people who lived on the land that would become Iowa. The Meskwaki Nation is an important part of Iowa's past and present. Like all other Native people in the United States, the Meskwaki were forced off of their ancestral lands and resettled on a reservation by the federal government. This is the point in the story where the history of the Meskwaki differs from those of other Native groups. The Meskwaki purchased 80 acres in Iowa, in Tama County, in 1857, and they created their own settlement. I spoke to Jonathan Buffalo, Historic Preservation Director for the Meskwaki Nation, back in 2011. I asked him to take us back through time, before the interference of European settlers, to tell me where the Meskwaki lived in the land that would become the United States. Where did the Meskwaki live in the United States?
Our homeland is within what's known as the Northeast, but at the beginning, we were at the eastern end of this area, and through migrations, took a couple thousand years to migrate from Montreal, Quebec area to Massachusetts, New York, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, then eventually into Iowa.
And was it settlement pressures that had your people moving, or was this a natural progression?
A little bit of both. Sometimes it was war, and sometimes it was weather change.
The first interaction that the Meskwaki people had with settlers were with French settlers.
Yes.
And we often hear the Meskwaki people called the fox or the sack and fox. And I think that first interaction with the French settlers is where the confusion with your name really begins. The French settlers renamed your people, right?
Well, our name, our creator-given name is Meskwaki, Meskwaki, Red Earth People. But when we met the French, they called us Renards, because there's a lot of different reasons why people say we were called fox. But the French called us Renards. And then when the French left and the British came in, they translated it to fox. So when the Americans come, by that time, the Sac tribe and the Fox tribe were in Iowa. Throughout our history, if you found one, you found the other. So when the Americans come, they're mostly purchasing land. And both tribes occupied the same area, so the government didn't want to buy the same land two times. So they created the Sac and Fox tribe. So treaty name, in some point, we have to use Sac and Fox.
That is your official name as according to the United States government, mm-hmm. then. But the linkage of the two tribes, the Sauk and the Meskwaki, why are you linked?
We have the same creation story. We're from the same area of Montreal, Quebec, St. Lawrence River Valley. Along with the other Algonquin tribes, we migrated southwest. So we've always been together. The only time that we've been separate is when, in Kansas, we decided to come back to Iowa, and they decided to go to Oklahoma. But there's still a political, cultural connection. But the physical connection, that's how long we've been apart physically. But before that, we were always close by.
The federal government created a reservation. They resettled the Meskwaki people to Kansas. And as I mentioned, the Meskwaki people didn't stay in Kansas. They wanted to come back to Iowa, and they actually purchased land in Iowa. And what makes this so remarkable is that it was against the law for Native people to purchase land. How did that come about?
Well, this Iowa Meskwaki experiment wouldn't have worked 10 years before, and it wouldn't have worked 10 years after. The 1850s is a very particular time in our history, tribal, state, and national history. It's pre-Civil War. So when we were looking for land in Iowa, there was a lot of anti-slavery sentiment. So we started talking to the local politicians. Grinnell, you know, was one of them. And they started petitions by 1852. And then by 1856, Iowa passed a law allowing our continuing residence. Then the following year, we purchased land from Isaac Butler, which when we talked to the governor in 1856, he told the tribe that as governor, he couldn't force his citizens to give us land. We would have to find that person. So we found him in Isaac Butler that was willing to sell us land, which is very unique in history. Iowa should be proud of that fact. When Iowa was selling land to a bunch of Indians, California was basically exterminating their Indians in the 1850s. You got to remember the 1850s. Mm-hmm. It was a very different time.
That first purchase of land was not large. It was 80 acres. How many Meskwaki people came and settled on that land?
About 300, roughly 300 people. And another 300 went on to Oklahoma. But the difference between us and the ones that went to Oklahoma, we kept our Meskwaki identity. We keep insisting that we're Meskwaki people. The Meskwakis that went on to Oklahoma got absorbed into the Sac and Fox Nation. You know, that's who they are today, the Sac and Fox Nation. But we keep insisting that we are Meskwakis. We will always be Meskwakis.
In forming that settlement in the 1850s, the federal government didn't immediately recognize your authority to have that land and to be a free people there. And that must have really impacted the Meskwaki who were living on that land in a number of different ways. And one of the ways is I'm sure that there were more freedoms because at that time, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was engaging in a lot of re-education and trying to force assimilation among the Native people. But at the same time, you also weren't receiving any of the benefits from the federal government. What was early life on the settlement like?
Well, the tribe lived in what they were purchasing in the 1850s was a summer village. 80 acres would be a summer village.
Okay.
So they lived in a summer village in the summer months. Then in about this time, we would start getting ready to go to our winter camps. And some people went to Marengo, the Amanas. Some went to Linn County. Some went to Blackhawk County. But they spread out to their winter camps. And then in the spring, they would go back to the summer village, fix up the summer houses, plant their crops, and settle down for the summer.
So where were they living in the winter? If they went to their winter quarters, they didn't own land in those areas. How were they able to live?
Because in the 1850s, before barbed wire became such a thing, people, the tribe had a little bit freedom of movement. They were friends with the farmers, the settlers. They were still around. They still had a personal relationship. They knew us and we knew them. When we came up the road, they knew it was Meskwakis and not Sioux, things like that. We recognized people and they recognized us more so than they do today.
So, Jonathan, after the federal government recognized that the Meskwaki people had purchased this land and created their own settlement, with that recognition came some benefits, I believe, in the form of an annuity from the federal government, but it also came with government control. So they treated the Meskwaki people much like other Native people were being treated on reservations all over the United States, right?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
Because even though we were under the reservation system, we were not technically a reservation. We paid taxes from 1875 to 1976. So as landowners, we had a little more control than most tribes. We escaped the allotment policy, and we always held and hold our lands in common. And that's been one of our main strengths as a people. So we escaped some policies, federal policies that devastated some tribes because of the fact that we paid taxes, we owned our land in common, and we were a tribe.
As far as education, what kind of role did the government play in the education of the children of the Meskwaki people?
Well, the Meskwaki have always had a reputation of being anti-education, which isn't quite true. We weren't anti-knowledge. If we were anti-knowledge as a people, we would not be here today because we would have not had learned how to load a gun, fix a gun. So we were never anti-knowledge. We were anti-education in the sense that our children were being acculturated through the educational system. That's what the tribe was against for, because that was a process. It wasn't for education's sake.
Right.
It was for a purpose.
Well, and we should talk more about that for people who aren't familiar with the history. The federal government had schools on reservations, and at those schools, teachers from outside the reservation were brought in, and Native languages were completely ignored. This was an effort to educate the children on these reservations, just like all other children around the United States were being educated, with ignoring their culture and their past, right?
Yes, because it's a three-pronged attack. It's the missionaries on one hand, the teachers, and the agents, all working together to acculturate a tribe. So one of the things they attacked was language, because with language you communicate with your own people, emotions, wants and needs, you know, things like that. Then the missionaries attacked the religious values. Then the agents attacked the political values. So once they destroyed all three, then the tribe would be basically at the mercy of those people.
As the schools were run by the federal government, how did they try to get the children of the Meskwaki to attend them? Was there a resistance to that?
There was some resistance, and parents would go to jail. Their annuities would be withheld. And then towards the end, they threatened to send our children to boarding schools out of state, which they did.
As all of this was happening, obviously this effort to educate the children of the Meskwaki people separate from the tribe and not teach them about their culture and their past, and to have them speak English, not their native language. As all of that was going on, what were the Meskwaki people doing to protect their culture, to try to have it carry on?
Well, just by living, just by trying to teach the children, you know, because eventually the tribe realized that we needed education if we were going to go and live with other people, the dominant people, their language, their monetary value, things like that. We had to learn how to count in English, spell in English, things like that. So we wouldn't get cheated when we went to that local store.
Right.
You know, we wouldn't. We found out that we needed some of that. But as a people, we have a saying, we Meskwakiize things. You know, we take an idea and then we tinker with it.
Mm-hmm.
Then we make it our own. So eventually we made education our own way, which we still continue today.
And when were the Meskwaki able to take control of their own school?
1981.
So not so very long ago.
Not so long ago.
Tell me a little bit about your traditional religion.
Well, I can't tell you that much, but we do believe in a great spirit, and we do have a belief system. We do have our own creation story. We have our own ceremonial life, you know, that we do. And we believe in it just as much as any other people believe in their beliefs.
And how have you been able to maintain that part of your culture? You talked about the missionaries and the pressures from other religious groups to assimilate. How have you been able to maintain that?
Just by being Meskwaki. Just the core belief is I am a Meskwaki. And my creator gave me my beliefs. And everything falls after that. Everything follows that. And once you believe that you're still Meskwaki, that's the core idea, is that I am a Meskwaki.
Jonathan Buffalo is Historic Preservation Director for the Meskwaki Nation. Thank you for learning with Talk of Iowa during this strange school year. Talk of Iowa's summer camp starts Tuesday with astronomy camp and will feature different fun summer camp experiences every Tuesday morning at 10 throughout the summer. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.